Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Sword and Trowel, and I want to take this opportunity especially to thank our Founders Alliance members who, through their faithful support week in, week out, month in, month out, enable us to produce this kind of content and distribute it to you freely. Today, we're going to have a conversation about what took place in the most recent Southern Baptist Convention. Welcome to The Sword and Trowel. Sword and Trowel is a podcast of Founders Ministries, and Founders exists for the recovery of the gospel and the reformation of local churches. And I'm Tom Askell, and this is...
David Strock.
David Mitzenmacher.
Graham Gundon.
And we are coming to you today with a very special episode of The Sword and Trowel in order to talk about what took place in the most recent Southern Baptist Convention in Indianapolis. This is SBC 2024. David, you're here teaching a course for the Institute of Public Theology. This is Systematic Theology 2. Is that correct?
Sir, that is.
And you've just finished up your first day.
I did.
Yep. And David, you are a pastor here at Grace Baptist Church with Graham and me, and have been on the field now for almost a year.
Almost a year, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so we're delighted to have you join us today for this episode. And you also were in Indianapolis, as was the other David, right?
Yep, I was there.
Graham, you were a slacker this year and didn't go to Indianapolis.
I drew the long straw and had to stay home. I watched part of the the convention this year. Actually, the only part of the convention I watched was your cordial conversation that you had with Brent Leatherwood in front of 10,000 people.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I missed that. So I need to go back and find that cordial conversation. Yeah. So we've had a lot of questions, not just from the people in our church, but also pastors and others reaching out to us about what our assessment is of what took place at the SBC. And David, man, with you being in town, we took advantage of that for the congregation here to talk about that a little bit last Sunday. So we just want to have a similar conversation today. So let me start with, first of all, acknowledging, Graham, since you weren't there, you probably would be the one to maybe drill down on certain things and make sure we don't just
assume. I have questions.
You have questions?
I have questions.
Well, I was there and I have questions, so that's going to be fine. But why don't we start with maybe just like four, a couple of highlights for each of you.
Yeah, I mean, every time the SBC, it's always a highlight to see friends that I haven't seen for a long time.
Yeah.
Right, and certainly co-laborers in different parts of the country, different parts of the world. So that's always an encouraging thing to be able to be there. I think Christ Overall, which is a ministry that began with us 2 years ago, it was encouraging to have, you know, just another opportunity for us to sing actually while we were there. That was actually something that was kind of new. So on Monday night, we gathered about 150 people or so outside to be able to sing and hand out the books from Joe Rigney. And that was just a really sweet time and just an encouraging time that was there. So that was probably some of the highlights from the week.
Great.
I think for me, it's always encouraging to be reminded of the universal church, the fellowship that we have, the like-mindedness we have of others who just want to see the gospel advance and Christ be honored. So that was a highlight. And then I think, I'm not being paid to say this, but the founder's lunch was definitely a highlight. I think that was a really important and timely event that helped, I think, a lot of messengers think rightly about how to navigate this cultural moment.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Founders went in with the Center for Baptist Leadership and had this lunch. I think Christ Overall also helped sponsor that, and so others that were involved in it. But we had Meg Basham there. She was kind of the keynote that gave a little address based upon her forthcoming book, Shepherds for Sale, which releases July 30th. Of 2024, so a little bit more than a month after this is being recorded.
And we've done an interview with her, an episode on that.
That's right, yeah. So you can go back and find an earlier podcast of Meg talking about that book. And we did everything we could to try to get the book out earlier, but there was no way that the publisher was going to release it earlier because of various reasons, not the least of which is that there are threats of lawsuits because of the things that she has uncovered in her research into the evangelical world, and specifically into the Southern Baptist Convention. Yeah. So that lunch was a real highlight. And then giving away the books as well, I think between Christ Overall and us, and I don't remember who else, maybe it's just the two of us that went in.
The booth, you guys handed out books there at the booth?
Yeah. So we gave them away for free.
That's right.
You know, so we gave 1,200 copies of Joe Rigney's book, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, away. And then Founders also gave away, I don't know how many, 100, 200 copies of the revolutionary reading of Romans 13. And then I still don't have the final count, but hundreds, if not thousands, of copies of other resources as well. So that was definitely a highlight for me. So, Graham, having missed out on it, man, what are the burning questions that you have about what took place?
Well, I think it might be good just to talk about, you know, things are fluid. You know, I had pastors texting me beforehand, like, hey, what are we looking at going into the convention? What are the things that we're going to need to make decisions on? How should we be prepared going into it? And there are certainly those things, I think, going into it. What's on the docket? What are we going to do? But, I mean, things also change when you're there, and things did change. I mean, you did votes on certain things that you guys did not anticipate doing. You made motions that you did not anticipate making, maybe even 24 hours before you made the motion.
Or 30 seconds.
So I think it'd be good to say, okay, what were the things that we were looking at, the important things we want to address in this business meeting this year, and then how things changed as the 2 days went on?
Well, I know, David Mitzenmacher, you submitted a resolution on religious liberty. And that resolution was published, I think, at the Center for Baptist Leadership, and you commented on it, wrote an article about it. There was a resolution brought out of the committee on religious liberty. There was nothing at all like the one that you submitted. And I think, didn't you get some kind of notice about, you know, this answers what you were trying to do?
Yeah, the stated intent of the resolution committee was to have one single resolution that broadly covered the topic of religious liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what came out really reflected a difference in views on what's going on in the world, right? Do we believe that the clear and present danger for religious liberty is Christians using the power of the state to force conversions? I don't see that to be the pressing issue of the day. Or do we believe that the pressing issue of religious liberty is protecting the religious liberty of Christians to proclaim the gospel and to practice our faith when we have a government that seems to hate the things of God? And so I think you just saw a difference in, you know, it's a little cliched what time it is. And so I think we did our best to get the resolution that was brought forward edited as best we could. There was an attempt that I made at the last minute to insert some language that would make a little more clear that the Southern Baptist commitment to religious liberty also applies to our own religious liberty and not just the religious liberty of those who would like to build mosques and whatnot. I didn't anticipate it being as controversial as it was, but it made for a fun moment of parliamentary intrigue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your attempted amendments, I thought the amendments were great. I wish they'd been accepted, and it was very, very close. But I look at that religious liberty resolution, and again, it's okay. It would have been much better in 1955. You know, right. I think it would have fit perfectly right then. But recognizing what's going on today, and I don't know if you referred to this, the anti-Semitism bill. What did you actually refer to that in one of your amendments?
I did. And then when I was given the opportunity to speak from the floor, right, there's, you know, this hypothetical Twitter debate really is what it is about whether or not we should long for a Christian prince. And that's all very theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, there's an actual piece of legislation that made its way through the House and is making its way to the Senate. That none other than Al Mohler said this represents a significant threat to religious liberty and would outlaw Orthodox Christianity and the proclamation of the gospel. And so in my mind, I don't lose a lot of sleep on things that don't seem to be anything that we're going to be dealing with anytime soon. And I do get really concerned about actual legislation that seems to be making its way with a head of steam through the process. Especially when the head of our Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission went on record speaking on behalf of Southern Baptists, saying this bill is a wonderful thing and it should be passed swiftly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, you don't win every vote, but I think at the very least, yeah, not on this side, but. But I think at the very least, maybe some messengers, some pastors. Paused for a moment and said, wait a minute, are we fighting the right battles or should we maybe be a little more attuned to what's actually happening and not debates between seminary professors?
Yeah, that was a valiant effort. And I did go back after that bill passed the House. I went back and read it, and it makes reference and refers to the definition of anti-Semitism, tying it to the International Holocaust Organization. I forget what
Remembrance Association.
Yeah, Remembrance. Right. That's what it is. Which they, after giving the definition, give examples of what would be violations of it, and the, included in the examples are to say the Jews killed Jesus. Okay, well, that's a problem, you know, if we're going to read the Bible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So appreciate the valiant effort. It was voted down, and so we didn't get the amendments, and we do have something that says we're for religious freedom for everybody.
Yeah.
So, David, the big thing going into the convention was the law amendment. And I would assume that many people listening to this, certainly the people who have been reaching out to us, would know what it is. But there are probably some that don't know what the law amendment is, why it's called the law amendment. I mean, we're not going back to legalism, are we? So
we're opposed to lawlessness.
That's right.
That's a good thing, right? So that might be the alternative there. But yeah, it's named after Mike Law, right? Who's a faithful pastor in Northern Virginia, who in his own area, my area as well, he's about 15 miles away from me, you know, prays for churches in the area, and discovered a couple years ago that about five of those churches have women as senior pastor was one of them, and other pastors who are there, and began to just kind of talk to, you know, entity heads and leaders in the SBC, and realized that the credentials committee did not want to act on that when he brought that to their attention. And so received counsel to bring that to the floor of Anaheim in 2022, brought an amendment to the Constitution that would make it clear that someone could not be in friendly cooperation, could not be a partner with SBC churches if they had a female pastor. And one of the things he was adding there is of any kind. You know, and that got to be one of the debates that we had on the floor and other places as well, is that, you know, many who would call themselves complementarian today are those who'd say, well, that's true for the senior pastor. But that's not true for other pastors of other kinds, you know, children's pastor or discipleship pastor or something like that. And so that led into just an opportunity for really to think carefully about, okay, what does the Bible say? And are we going to go with the Bible? Are we, you know, kind of captivated by making sure that everyone feels good along the way? But it just, it was a really helpful kind of bellwether to see where is the SBC? And so after 2022, in 2023, New Orleans ratified maybe by 80%. There was a vote from the floor, and everyone seemed to be for that at that time. And so that was ratified the first time. Of course, it takes two consecutive years to ratify something to be added to the Constitution. And there was a need for 66% for that vote to be able to pass at a supermajority, and it got 61%. And so came close, but did not make it sufficiently to do that. And so that motion then failed for the moment, which I think for the moment was deeply discouraging, as many were involved in supporting that and writing articles for that, supporting that along the way, even with videos. But in short time after that, I think there was great encouragement to say, okay, 61% voted for this. More than 90% voted for the removal of FBC Alexandria. The convention documents are complementarian. The world that is watching is trying to paint the SBC as moving away from that. This failed in some measure. But really, I think it has galvanized many conversations to say, okay, what do we need to do to be a convention that is going to continue to go with the Bible and not with just the platitudes of culture?
So tell us about First Baptist Church of Alexandria.
Yeah, so that would be one of the churches that is in Northern Virginia as well. So it's Alexandria, Virginia. Mike is from Arlington, just down the street. And they, for really 2 years, the Credentials Committee had information to say that they were a church that, come to find out, for 40 years have had, you know, at least a willingness or female pastors who are on staff there. And as that was kind of considered, they came out very strongly for the need to have female pastors in place, which is in violation of 1 Timothy 2, 1 Timothy 3, the Baptist Faith and Message, all of those things. And so they spoke at the convention in defense of that. And it was really interesting because the Credentials Committee did not actually seek to remove them because they had female pastors of any kind, but because they were willing to receive a senior pastor that was female. And so that's an interesting little wrinkle that is going to continue to be a point of conversation that is there. But when that vote came to the floor, more than 90% then voted for them to be removed from the SBC, like Saddleback last year, like Fern Creek Baptist Church as well.
Well, as you know, this month is June, and it is Pride Month, and we are very proud of what the Lord has done in us in creating us male and female. And so for this month, we are doing a special for anyone who joins the Founders Alliance membership. We are giving away The Beauty of the Binary by Luke Griffo. Male and female, he created them. Just go to founders.org/give, and you can join at any level in the fam, and we will send you a copy of The Beauty of the Binary.
Yeah, this is maybe a question for, it's a historical question for Baptists. I mean, why is it that when so many Baptists read that word pastor, like automatically in their mind, senior pastor, that's what they read, senior pastor. Why is that? I mean, is there something in Baptist church history and our ecclesiology that would make us to do that? I mean, because when I read it, understanding the scriptures, I mean, pastor is a pastor, whether it's a senior pastor or associate or whoever it is.
Yeah, I know. I don't think there's anything beyond the last few decades in Baptist history that would lead to that, because it's very common to find pastors referred to as elders in Baptist history. In fact, I'm thinking about a church planter, I can't call his name, who was very active in the 19th century throughout the southern states planting churches. He planted First Baptist Clinton of Louisiana, First Baptist Jackson, Louisiana, other churches, and they, in all the records, it's elder so-and-so, elder so-and-so. I think with the loss of elders and the having only deacons, and that's an interesting study. We had a pastor here one time, Steve Haynes, who went to be a missionary from our church in South America. But Steve did his dissertation at Southwestern Seminary on the loss of church discipline in Southern Baptist churches across the 19th century, or Baptist churches in the South. And as a little sidelight to that, he came up with a theory, never pursued it, that he thinks that Baptist churches kind of let elders die off because the main preaching elder began to be subjected to some abuse by other elders who didn't have as greater frequency preaching, and that just to kind of let that die out, the deacons were easier to handle. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was Steve's thesis, at least from some of his research. But for whatever reason, elders became associated with Presbyterians, basically. And so even we've seen in our lifetimes how this has begun to reemerge, and many, many Baptist churches now have elders, a plurality, as we do here at Grace. And with that, how do you distinguish between the first among equals, you know, the main preaching pastor? I think, what is the title you have at your church?
Yeah, pastor of preaching and theology.
Okay, pastor of preaching and theology. I mean, it's a kind of a prudential type of thing to identify, here's what is going on, some of your main duties. So, yeah, senior pastor has come to be a little out, it seems like, for some who don't want the absolute acknowledgement that, yeah, pastor is reserved for qualified men according to the New Testament.
I wonder, too, how much of that, you know, we were talking earlier about pragmatism and that kind of being a bit of a theme of what we saw. And so as we've adopted these business models that sort of say, okay, well, my board of deacons is kind of it's similar to a board of directors, and then my senior pastor is the CEO of the organization, and you know, guys like Graham and I, we're the vice presidents, and so we're doing something important, but ultimately it's the CEO's show, and he's setting the vision, leading the thing. And I think as we've brought in those business models and really oriented so many churches around this sort of pragmatic, worldly approach, it's not surprising that on the other side of that, you would say, well, okay, it's really just about the guy, and everything else is not so much.
Yeah. So, you know, there was an argument made from the floor that, you know, we don't need to change the Constitution. We don't need to change, you know, the language there, because we've already got the tools that we need to be able to remove churches who are not in friendly cooperation, who are not affirming the BFNM. Therefore, all this is very unnecessary. And that was one of the arguments that one person from the floor gave for, hey, let's not adopt this law amendment. Were there other arguments that were kind of circulating at the time that maybe didn't make it to the floor?
Yeah, I think one of those was certainly the argument that this is unfairly treating African-American churches. Mm-hmm. Right, that this is targeting those because of their, you know, cultural background and having, you know, females who might be preaching, might be serving as pastors therein. And I say, at the end of the day, it's a question of what does the Bible say, right? That was never the intention that was there, even though that's been one of the accusations that was taking place there, or just a cultural insensitivity. And I say, the sensitivity is what does the Bible say and how do we apply that? And that's, again, transcultural for all ethnicities, for all churches at all times. And so I think that was certainly one of the things that had been said, but I think it's a misnomer of what the intentions of the law amendment was seeking to do.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, another argument was that this is anti-woman, that God gifts men and women equally. And so some women can have the gift of pastor, which I find to be incredibly inconsistent. And though they would call us misogynistic, I think their argument is more misogynistic because you can have the gift of pastor if you're a woman, but you can't be a senior pastor. And there are actually some who make that case. They don't want to be pressed on it. But yeah, they can be associate pastors with the gift of pastor. But if I get the gift of pastor as a man, I can be a senior pastor. So not a very cogent argument, but it was one that was out there as well.
There's also a set of really interesting bookend arguments that were made. One being, there is no problem because this is a tiny fraction of churches. It's not really a thing. And then another argument that said, if this passes, every convention from now on will be spent doing nothing but purging all of these churches with women pastors. And in some cases, it would seem like both arguments came from the same source. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's maybe views evolved over time, mm-hmm. Charitably.
And so, let me mention one other argument made from the Academy, that the greatest concern for facing Southern Baptists today is not women pastors, it's loss of the deity of Christ. I'm just that? The reporter, okay? I'm not, okay, I'm not yeah, arguing.
There's something not connecting in my mind.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so last year, you know, an overwhelming majority of messengers voted for the law amendment. This year, a near supermajority voted for the law amendment. So though the convention every year is not necessarily representative of the entirety of Southern Baptists, at each convention, a good majority over the past 2 years has been in favor of this amendment. Even so, it failed after 2 years. I mean, what's the strategy moving forward on this issue?
Well, before we get to that, can I just kind of underscore the point you just made? So last year, 80% by best estimates voted for this overwhelmingly. This year, only 61%. So what happened in a year? Why? And if you go back and just read the record, you'll see that many recognized leaders in the SBC pulled out all the stops to try to kill this amendment. Mm-hmm. And another point that we mustn't forget is that when Mike Law made this motion 3 years ago, it was referred to the executive committee. The executive committee was determined not to bring it out to be voted on by the convention in New Orleans last year. And I don't know if they ever gave a reason, but I know there was all kinds of pressure put on them publicly by people like us saying, no, we want to vote on this. We were told we would get to vote on this. You must bring it out. And so the executive committee, I think for the first time, at least to my knowledge, the first time in history, brought out a motion, a recommendation for an amendment to the Constitution, and then said, but we don't want you to vote for it. We're against it, but we're bringing it out. That's also a commentary. So I think what those realities suggest is that there may well be a disconnect between the people that we've been looking to as leaders and the churches themselves, which is certainly a case that I would be willing to try to make.
Well, yeah, and I think that is a segue to be able to see that that's one of the things that has galvanized so many, right? As far as I know, the largest lunch that was going on, at least on Tuesday, was the Center for Baptist Leadership with Founders Ministry, right? More than 1,000 people, yeah. And probably could have been more,
because
it ran out of room. Mm-hmm. But there was an incredible just energy that was there to say, look, there are good things in the SBC worth recovering. And so I think there will be ongoing efforts to be able to see those things taking place. There will be opportunities for conversations to be had to say, okay, what can be done? Because some of the decisions that have been made and some of the ways that some of the leaders have spoken down to in a very condescending way, mm-hmm. towards the Mike Law Amendment and other things, things has just said, oh, this doesn't seem to fit with what's going on. And you mentioned Meg Basham and the Shepherds for Sale book that is coming out, some of the things that she shared at that luncheon. When those things come to public light, we're going to have all kinds of conversation to say, who can we trust? Because it seems as though the trust of the messengers has been lost by many who have been leading the SBC.
And one of the things that concerns me, too, is we just got a new was the CEO, president of the EC, Jeff Yorge. And everything I've known about him has been good. But one of the first things he did was to write us a really strong article against the law amendment. And then his first speech, first act as the executive of the EC was basically to scold us for raising questions and being concerned. And that was a very poor step, I think, for his first public duty as the leader of the executive committee. So one of the things that we're going to need to do going forward is to remind Jeff and others that they serve the churches.
Right.
You know, we keep being told that the churches are the headquarters. Well, headquarters needs to stand up and call to account those that are serving us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's happening more and more.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Sword and the Trowel. I just wanted to make you aware that every order that you place this June at press.founders.org, everyone will get one of these vintage copies of the Founders Journal. This is coming from spring 2001, titled Ready for Reformation. Dr. Tom Nettles has a great article in here. I would definitely recommend you grab a book that you've been looking at this month so you can get this vintage copy of the Founders Journal as well. Go to press.founders.org.
Tom, you also had an opportunity to make an unexpected motion from the floor that caused not a little bit of fanfare there at the convention. What did you move to do at the convention?
Yeah, I moved to, in keeping with Bylaw 25 in the Constitution and bylaws of the Southern Baptist Convention, to abolish the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. That's the language of Bylaw 25. Now, had that motion passed, it only needed a majority, a simple majority, to pass, the ERLC would not have gone into non-existence immediately because it takes 2 years, wisely. It takes 2 years for a convention to have a majority that say, yeah, we think that this entity ought to no longer exist. And, you know, my desire was born out of frustration. I didn't plan and go there planning to do this, but hearing Meg speak and just thinking about that after that lunch, going back in, there was an opportunity to present more motions for debate. And so I just walked to a mic and was able to do that, but we ran out of time and there was more time put on the clock to do that. And the reason is the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission is out of step. They're out of touch with our churches. And I've been banging this drum for years. When Brent Leatherwood became the president of the ERLC, I pretty quickly called upon him to resign because he signed an open letter to state legislators. I mean, this is a letter directed to state legislatures saying basically that we will not, we absolutely, unequivocally, is the language they use, will not support any legislation that holds women to be accountable for aborting their children. And that letter was issued publicly at the same time that there was a bill, the first bill in the history of the United States that had a real opportunity to come out, there was support for it, that would have abolished abortion and given equal protection under the law for preborn babies in Louisiana. And when the legislators saw that open letter, the ones that had been for it and willing to go on the record to push it forward, they got cold feet and they pulled back. Well, I believe the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission bears a great deal of responsibility in that. And so, there, you know, it's nothing personal. I don't know Brent. He's probably a great guy. But in terms of policies and the Holocaust of unborn children in our nation, that was a miscarriage of justice. It was a dereliction of duty. And so what I was hoping to do is get a majority that would vote to say, yeah, okay, we got to do this 2 years in a row. Let's do it this year. That'll be a shot across the bow. And we can say to the ERLC, okay, you've heard from headquarters. You've got a year to clean up your act. You've got a year to come back to your mission. And if you don't, then next year we can pull the plug. And we don't want to, but we can, and if necessary, we will.
Well, and it's certainly not just, you know, Brent Leatherwood. The ERLC has a long history of failures going back to Russell Moore's presidency and even before that as well. Right.
Well, and I think you mentioned you had intended to use this as a shot across the bow and maybe a call to reform. Well, as much as those types of motions were characterized as, what was it, crazy uncles or something like that, cranky uncles, the yes votes were non-trivial. Yeah. And not only that, but that was one of, I believe it was half a dozen motions brought from the floor that specifically expressed some serious concerns about the ERLC. I hope it's not lost on anyone. There are different things we could see from other entities and say, well, I wish they would do this, or I'm disappointed by that. There was not a half dozen motions brought from the floor that directly expressed dissatisfaction. And those motions that did make it did not have that level of, it wasn't a majority, but if I'm Brent Leatherwood and I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the room, at the very least you would say, okay, clearly there's work that needs to be done to regain the trust of a unignorable number of Southern Baptist churches. And the fact that the response was not that, I think, was really telling. Like you would hope that that would have served as a shot across the bow just in and of itself. The fact that that motion even had to be made, the fact that it wasn't a fringe motion, the fact that it wasn't alone and there were similar motions, there's clearly some dissatisfaction. And this is prior to Meg's book coming out.
Mm-hmm. Well, it reminds me as well. I mean, so not just Brent Leatherwood, but also the trustees of the ERLC should see that also.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think one of the things that it's too easy for our trustees, and I haven't been in those rooms, but I do wonder if they're actually keeping account of those who are leading, or if they are in so many ways just kind of serving to put wind in the sails of those who are leading those groups, right? Yeah. Especially with the ERLC. Right. There seems to be, for almost going back a decade, all sorts of questions and concerns, right? And so to hear that, okay, a motion was made to abolish the ERLC, that seems extreme. And yet, it's not extreme as across the whole convention, orange ballots are going up everywhere because so many people have seen the problems that have been mentioned.
Yeah, and from where I was sitting, it looked like maybe 60-40, maybe 55-45. Was a split on the vote. People in the back have contacted me. I got an email, and a couple other folks contacted us and said that they thought it was 50-50 and should have been a ballot vote. But there was no hesitation from the chair, and I believe Bart's honest, and so I'm not challenging the ruling on that at all. But it was a sizable number. And you mentioned the trustees. It's one of the concerns that I have about what's going on in the SBC is our trustee system needs to be repaired. It's broken. I've had trustees tell me that whenever they were put on the boards, that they were brought in by the entity, they were wined and dined, and they wind up being almost like an unpaid PR staff for the entity that they serve. If you want a little example of this, listen to the interview that William Wolfe did at the Center of Baptist for Baptist Leadership with John Whitehead, who is a trustee of the ERLC, who did try to raise some concerns when Russell Moore, in his last year there, he was concerned about him. Mm-hmm. And the chairman of the board, along with others, said, oh, no, there's nothing to see here. Well, John has all of the receipts. He's got the emails, the exchanges. So if you just go listen to that podcast, then you'll get a glimpse from one of our entities of how the trustee system has worked, that it should never have worked like that. Mm-hmm. So, we definitely need to develop a new way of training our trustees, reminding them what their fiduciary responsibilities are, and then just helping them to remember you're to hold the entities accountable to the churches. Mm-hmm. You're not to silence the churches who have questions about the entities.
Yeah, well said.
And that seems to always just be the posture. I mean, this isn't the case for everyone from the platform, but so often the school marming to the dirty masses, you know, below. It's just so frequently is the posture of leadership within the SBC. And there's a reason why there's distrust. Mm-hmm. Now, Tom, you got to speak to the motion you made. You got to argue for the abolishment of the ERLC. But then Brendan Leatherwood was able to come up and speak gently and turn away your wrath. Was your wrath assuaged after he spoke against you?
Well, I didn't know I had wrath until he told me that I did.
Everyone else knew after
that's
he spoke.
That's right. You know, a gentle answer turns away wrath, and all these political things that come up every year. You know, I mean, there's nothing personal. Again, I don't know Brent Leatherwood. I'm not even sure I would recognize him, you know, if we passed each other on the street. We did pass each other on the street, I was told, and I didn't recognize him. So it's nothing personal, but yeah, there was some impugning of character in what he said. Mm. And I think it would have been very much in line had he been called out of order at that point, though Dr. Barber ruled, well, you've had an opportunity to speak, so we're going to let it go. And that's fine. You know, it's, again, no personal animosity there, but it's indicative. I think that is a good indication of the way that entity leaders think about pastors in the SBC, and it's exactly 180 degrees opposite of how we ought to be thinking.
Well, it's important, I think, just across the board today, that if a critical word is spoken, it's immediately assumed that that's wrathful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A critical word is not wrathful.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, a critical word is identifying something. I mean, faithful are the wounds of a friend. Mm. Like, you could also quote that proverb.
That's right.
And if you quoted that proverb, you might have actually gained a friend to be able to say, okay, there's some problems here. Let's work towards that. But instead, it's using a scripture that is actually, you know, we talked about this with Joe Rigney's book. And this was actually, you know, cited by, you know, Dean and Sarah, right? Mm. To not be steered, right? That there's a way in which that kind of emotionalism that is taking something that's an important point, a logical point, and turning it emotional. Right. And therefore, we're not able to have the kind of conversation that is needed to make headway together.
Yeah, that's a great point. Great point.
So, you know, there were some good things that happened in the convention. There were some discouraging things that happened. Each of these three things that you men discussed, none of them went the way perhaps that we would have wanted them to go. So when are we leaving the convention?
This is not the time to be talking about leaving the convention. I think there's real opportunity here, and opportunity for what? You know, well, opportunity to see the SBC become healthier. Mm. I mean, that's my desire. People say, oh, you're just power hungry. Well, if I'm power hungry, I should be the most frustrated Southern Baptist in the world because I have zero official power, never have had. I hadn't been appointed to be dog catcher, you know.
Tom and I wanted to invite you to come and join us down here in sunny Southwest Florida, January 23rd through the 25th for our National Founders Conference. This next theme for next year is going to be Revive Us, O Lord, a whole conference on revival. Dr. Tom Askell, Dr. Bodie Bauckham, Jeff Johnson, Dr. Joel Beakey will be some of the speakers that will be there with us. It's going to be a wonderful time, as the Founders National Conferences always are, of fellowship and growing in the Word. So go to founders.org, look at some of the information on the conference. We'd love to have you here. And if you'd like more information, you can see some of that at the end of this podcast.
So I think the SBC has opportunity to become increasingly healthy. I think we've gone in some bad directions the last few years under poor leadership. And, you know, again, nothing personal, but I just think the record testifies to that. And we have opportunity to see it become better. And here's the reality. The SBC is not going away. If all the good churches pulled out of the SBC tomorrow, it will continue on probably till Jesus returns. Look at the PCUSA. Look at the United Methodist Church. If you want just a little bit of an example of what happens to these ecclesiastical organizations, though we're not the PCA and we're not our PCUSA or the UMC, nevertheless, look what happens. They just continue to go worse and worse in the hands of bad actors. And so given that, and given the fact that every Southern Baptist Church is independent and autonomous, and so nobody dictates to us what we do, what we have to do or should do, I think that this is a very opportune time to try to shore up the effort to make the SBC healthier, because it's done a lot of good. It does a lot of good still this very day. And why wouldn't we want to see it do better? Why wouldn't we want to see it resist the cultural waves and winds that are trying to steer us into horrible pathways, as Meg Basham's book demonstrates with documentation. Mm-hmm. So again, if you think, you know, we're just conspiracy theorists or talking about stuff we don't know about, July 30th, buy the book, check the footnotes.
Yeah, if I can answer the same question about when are we going to leave the SBC, our church in Northern Virginia, well, we left the SBC last week, right? It only meets a couple of days out of the year, right? And so, I mean, again, I think those who are most committed to their own local church, they're going to spend the bulk of their energy and their efforts in their local body, continue to preach the gospel, share the gospel, disciple all the rest. But because one of the ways that we are a local church that is related to other churches in our area and throughout the country, the SBC is going to continue to be there, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And either we can be assisting to see it go in a good direction or just, you know, hand it over to whomever. And the whomever are the leftist media, the leftist organizations that are funneling all kinds of money to turn the SBC in a direction that will have an impact on our church or your church or other churches throughout the country. Our church has tons of military, and so we're receiving people from SBC churches all the time. We're sending them out to all sorts of places around the world. Many of those churches are SBC. And so we care deeply about the health of other churches. And one of the ways that we can play a small role in that is to help argue for good motions, for good trustees, for good partnerships in the SBC. And so that takes 2 days out of the year to gather with some preparation ahead of time to know what's going on and to continue to pray that the Lord would use those churches in the SBC for good.
Mm. I think for answering the same question, I think for many going in, we sort of viewed the law amendment as the litmus test. And I think it's really important that we don't buy into the false narrative here that somehow those who were against the law amendment had the majority. They did not. I went and looked, I think the 84 election, Reagan versus Mondale, Reagan got 58% of the popular vote, and it was described as as this like overwhelming mandate from the voters at 58%. 61% said, yeah, this makes sense. And let's take people at their word. A non-trivial number of that vocal minority who kept us from getting the supermajority said, I agree with it, but I don't think it's necessary, or I think the wording could be tightened up. So let's take them at their word, right? So upwards of 61% made very clear that actually, no, our position has not changed on that mm-hmm. issue. And so I think if we're viewing that as the litmus test and making our decisions based on that issue alone, I was talking to someone who doesn't follow these things, and maybe it's not a great analogy, but it will preach. I said, you know, we had the opportunity to invoke the mercy rule. If we would have hit a grand slam, the game would have been over. Everyone would have gone home, and we hit a three runs instead. Mm-hmm. Right? We didn't trigger the mercy rule, but we're still winning mm-hmm. By a lot. And so when I've gotten the text saying, "Hey, should we pack it up and go home?" It's like, why? Why would we shrink the 61%? Where yeah. the SBC is influential. It's not going away. It's important. It's not as if we're the ones who are this little niche that no one's listening to. Mm-hmm. So yeah, now's the time to perform. Like,
you know, one thing we hadn't talked about, we should talk about, is the presidential election. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Six people, I don't know if we've ever had more than that, mm-hmm. I can't remember, but six people were nominated. And to my knowledge, they were all, you know, people who would say we believe in the inerrancy of Scripture. And so in those regards, we would, you know, praise God, we're not having people who are not saying that. Two of the six, I know for sure, in talking to them, they were for the law amendment. They were for transparency that had been recommended from the floor that got voted down this year. And then a third one who got elected, Clint Presley, was for the law amendment, but he wasn't for the 990 transparency level, you know, in our entities. He was concerned about that. The sixth one, the last one, I don't know. I just know people who know him and say he's really a good guy, but he was against the law amendment. Again, I don't know him. Spencer, I think was his name, Pastor Spencer. The other two represented kind of the leadership that we've had for the last several years. And I've only talked to Mike Kibone maybe once or twice. He seemed like a really good guy, pastor in Oklahoma. Bruce Frank and I may have talked. I'm not sure. I think we may have talked once. I don't know him. He's been one of the main leaders of the sex abuse reform stuff, and I think he's made some very unwise decisions in that whole process. But those would have been the guys that would have caused people to celebrate who have been kind of driving the train, and neither one of them made it off the first ballot. So I think that goes to your point, David, that, yeah, there are people who recognize that that's not the way we want to go. And Clint, from, again, all I know, I don't know him well, but, you know, known him for several years, seems to be a stand-up guy. He seems to be a guy who's unafraid to do what needs to be done when he sees that it needs to be done. And so I have hope that we're going to see, you know, good things happen, better things happen these next couple of years than maybe what we've seen in the previous 7 or 8 years, you know, up until the last year or two.
Yeah, I mean, most objectively, the last 6 years, the presidents would have all opposed the law amendment.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
That's
so this correct. Is the first president we've had, maybe for more than 6 years, who came out in support of the law amendment.
Yeah.
I think that will be helpful. There's a hospitality for that kind of movement in the SBC. Mm-hmm. I think that'll be good.
Yes.
You know, there's this deep conservative impulse to give all of our resources to leftists. And I get it. I've got the impulse and I need to fight it daily.
Is that why you're on the left?
That's right. There's, and I'm not saying the Southern Baptist Convention is full of leftists. It's not, you know, we're not battling with, you know, people who deny the inerrancy of the scriptures and all
right.
that. But SBC definitely can go there.
Yeah.
You know, if we take our hand off the steering wheel, it'll go there real quick. And that'll happen if all the deeply conservative, committed churches leave the convention because, hey, things didn't go the way I wanted it to go. It seems like, you know, there's a bad trend in the SBC right now, so we're just going to leave. We're going to take our ball and go home. Well, that's where the SBC will head after not too long. And so what we need to do is we just need to fight for those resources the Lord's entrusted to us. There are other brothers and sisters in other churches, as you said, that, you know, we can help. We can help the SBC to be more healthy, which can in turn help them to be more healthy. We can send more and better missionaries onto the field. You know, the resolution that we passed this year condemning IVF. I was just listening to one political commentator speak about this. You know, the Republican Party has been really pushing very hard in the direction of enshrining IVF as like our political platform. That's what we want as Republicans. Well, the Southern Baptists coming out condemning it with that resolution does something.
Yeah,
it makes them sit up and pause and like, wait, hold on. The most influential religious group, Protestant group in the country is saying, no, we don't want that. Okay, well, maybe Ted Cruz is not going to support any more bills in favor of IVF. Yeah. So there's a lot there that we can be excited about. There's a lot there that we know the Lord can use us and use our churches to continue to steer the SBC in a good direction.
That's right. You wouldn't have billionaires pouring money into steering the SBC if the SBC, number one, didn't matter.
Right.
But number two, wasn't in its current state opposed to their interest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like that's just a fact. And so we need to keep that in mind.
Yep. Yeah, that's a great point. And I just want to say too, man, as pastors, we're all pastors. So we all have plenty to do in our churches, and Southern Baptist pastors who went to Indianapolis or who watched it or tried to keep up with it, going back to your churches, well, we got to do what God's called us to do in our local congregations. That's where the real action is. That's where we're going to be held accountable before God for how we shepherd the people of God. And the SBC has a place, and it can be good. We've made a case for that, I think, today. But man, don't let that distract you from what God's called you to do in your local church. And don't feel like that if you stay identified with the SBC, you can't do that. Or if you're going to really be a faithful pastor, you got to be SBC. I don't think either one of those is true. We've all had friends who've pulled out of the SBC. And, you know, I don't try to talk people out of it. That's between you and God, if that's where you need to be. But recognize that you can do everything you need to do as a faithful pastor. You got plenty to do by looking at that flock every week, shepherding those people, bringing them God's word, reminding them the gospel, helping them to remember the Lord Jesus Christ. And if you have opportunity to join together with other like-minded churches to try to make this ecclesiastical organization healthier, man, that's a bonus. Mm. And so if we can do that together, then let's link arms and do that.
Amen.
Well, thank you for joining us today on the Sword and Trowel for this conversation. It's a conversation that is pertinent to us and is timely because of what's just happened in the recent Southern Baptist Convention in Indianapolis. But for those of you that are not Southern Baptists, we understand that this may not be exciting to you, but it does matter. And if you're a Christian, if you are in an evangelical church, what happens in the SBC does affect your circles in your own evangelical world. So thanks for tuning in. If it's been useful to you, please pass it around. Let other people know about it as well.